fasten your seatbelts and turn up your radio. We're going on a road trip.
Pollinators, pollinators, are the reason this world can eat. Pollinators, pollinators, are the reason this world can eat.
Wild and managed pollinators, from bees to butterflies and more, offer a wide range of benefits to society in terms of contributions to food security, farmer and beekeeper livelihoods, social and cultural values, as well as maintaining a wider biodiversity and ecosystem stability. More than 1,300 types of plants are grown worldwide for food, beverages, medications, condiments, spices, and even fabric. Of these, about 75% are pollinated, and more than one of every three bites of food we eat and beverages we consume are made possible directly by pollinators. But despite their importance, pollinators are all too often taken for granted. Worldwide, there is an alarming decline in their populations, but what can be done about it? Welcome to Route 51. I'm Shereen Seward. Pollinators face numerous threats, including changes in land use and management intensity, pesticide use, genetically modified crops, and climate change, among others. Though their declines are well documented, there are ways to safeguard pollinator populations. Today, we take a look at the pollinators that have the greatest impact on Wisconsin, not the least of which are bees. And we'll hear ways to promote their stability right in our own backyards. Throughout the program, we invite you to join the conversation and ask your own questions by calling 800-780-9742, or you can email us at ideas@wpr.org. Dr. Michael Bauer is a retired family practice physician whose bees travel from Wisconsin to Florida and beyond to help pollinate the nation's food crops. Now living in Waupaca, Dr. Bauer is a founding member and instructor with the Nicaragua Bee Project. It's an organization that promotes economic empowerment through beekeeping education. Dr. Bauer, thank you so much for being here today.
Good morning.
Bill Korb. Bill Korb of Chippewa Falls is a beekeeper and bee enthusiast who teaches educational classes for the Chippewa Valley Beekeepers Association. He also produces beekeeping videos on YouTube as well. Bill, welcome to Route 51. Happy to have you here.
Thanks, Shereen. It's a pleasure to be with you.
A bit later in the program, we'll be joined by Sue Cripps. She is a naturalist and camp host at Lake Wissota State Park. She'll share some ideas on how to create a pollinator-friendly yard and discuss that science behind the no-mow May movement we're seeing so much about in cities in Wisconsin, including Wausau and Stevens Point. So, Dr. Bauer, I have to ask right off the bat, what is the Nicaragua Bee Project? It sounds really fascinating.
Yeah, that's been quite an adventure. We started that organization in 2014, and we teach pretty much rural farmers in Nicaragua to become beekeepers just to augment their family income. It's been quite the project.
How did you get involved in it?
Well, it started off, I did a couple tours with the USAID, United States Agency for International Development, teaching beekeeping in Haiti. And then I met a guy who at that time was president of an organization called the Wisconsin-Nicaragua Partnership. And he asked if I would come to Nicaragua and help with one of their communities learn beekeeping. And then so I went there for a couple of stints. And it was after that that we decided to start our own organization and just kind of stick with the Nicaragua. So that's kind of how I got into it.
Very interesting. Well, Bill, you are an avid beekeeper, and obviously bees are among the most common pollinators. How hard is it for bees to get through the winter? Do they have a dormant period that helps their health, or do they just keep on going?
Well, so the thing about bees is, you know, they're not like mammals that hibernate. They're actually active all winter long. In fact, the whole reason why bees collect honey and produce honey is that is their primary food source that gets them through the winter. They pack that away, you know, all spring and summer, and they will need, in our area, you know, we're just outside Chippewa Falls, they'll need somewhere between 90 and 120 pounds of honey stored in their hive in order to be able to overwinter. And so the cold weather can be a challenge. you know, depending on the beekeeper, some beekeepers, Mike alluded to, or you alluded to with Mike, they send them out of the state. I don't do that. I actually keep my bees all on my property all winter long. And depending on the year, it can be, sometimes I lose, you know, maybe only, I have four hives right now. Sometimes if I overwinter four, I might only lose one. I have a friend who lives a half mile from me. He had 10 hives going into the winter last fall, and he lost all 10. So it can be a real challenge. The cold is one thing, but one of the other things that you have to prepare for when you're overwintering bees is moisture. Moisture can actually be a bigger threat to the health of the hive in the winter than just the cold is. The bees keep themselves warm. They consume the honey, and then they use their own body heat to keep the cluster of bees inside the hive warm. But just like humans, when they exhale, there's water vapor in their exhalation, and warm air rises. That'll actually rise to the top of the hive. And when it condenses, then you get cold, potentially cold droplets of water that drip down onto the bees and can chill them. And that actually can be more detrimental to the health of the hive than the cold weather outside.
Does the weather, as far as precipitation, have an impact too? I mean, the amount of snow we get, or isn't that really a factor?
I mean, that's not as big of a deal. The only thing you have to worry about with the snow is, you know, the bees, a lot of people probably assume that, you know, once it gets cold outside, the bees don't come out at all. But that's not actually true. During a relatively warm winter day, they will come out on what's called a cleansing flight. Cleansing flights, bees, let's put it this way. Bees don't poop where they sleep. They go outside to go to the bathroom. And when we get a cold snap that lasts for a long time, they will hold it for weeks at a time. And they will wait for a warm, sunny day, warm being relative. I've seen bees flying outside my hives on sunny days in January when the high is only 25 degrees. They'll come out on a very short flight, take care of their business, and then go back into the hive. In fact, one of the things as a beekeeper that you look for in the winter is you look for dead bees in the snow in front of your hives. That actually is a good indication that your hives are healthy. That means the bees are actually coming out and going on cleansing flights. So talking about how much snow we get, you need to make sure that if you do get snow, if it covers the openings that they have that allow them to get out of the hive to go on their cleansing flights, you as the beekeeper need to get out there and make sure that they have a clear path to leave the hive to go on their cleansing flights.
So, Mike, what are some of the typical native bees we see here? What are some of the varieties? And I also want to ask you to explain the difference between a bee and a wasp.
Well, there obviously are the honeybees, which are not native to America. They came from Europe, so that's not a native species. We're supposed to have something like 13 different species of bumblebees that pollinate here, but several of those species have disappeared from Wisconsin, especially in the past 20 years, with the advent of this little parasitic mite, which has just been terrible for the bee industry. It's called Varroa destructans. We call it the Varroa mite. And it's just devastated the native bees. It's really hard on honeybees too, but there's treatments for that aren't fantastic, but at least are somewhat helpful. But the native bees, of course, you can't treat those. So it's been really tough on those bees, along with the climate change and the changing plants that produce nectar at certain times of the year. That's been a real challenge for the native bees. I see articles all the time that saying honeybees are endangered. Honeybees are not anywhere near to being endangered. In fact, the number of colonies in the U.S. has been steadily rising over the past 10 or 15 years due to the commercial bee industry. So the honeybee is not in danger of going extinct, but some of the native species are really in trouble. Like I said, I can't remember how many, but there's several species of bumblebees that have not been seen in Wisconsin for several years now. They've disappeared. And the difference between wasps and honeybees are you want to keep protecting the honeybee, and I don't care what you do with the wasps. They're just nasty things. Oh, my gosh. I'm sure Bill has got calls too. I'll have somebody say, "Oh, I've got a swarm of honeybees on my house. Come and get them." And you'll go there, and it's hornet nest or a wasp nest. Yeah. And they look totally different. Most of the wasps and hornets are carnivores, not really pollinators, although some do pollinate a little bit. They're not a major source of pollinating, not like the bumblebees we have here.
All right, so I should not feel bad about getting rid of the wasps.
Well, you won't hear me say that, but whatever you do with a wasp is fine with me.
Okay. Well, and actually, Shireen, one of the primary differences between honeybees and wasps is a wasp is a carnivore and a honeybee is an herbivore. Honeybees, their only source of nutrition is pollen and nectar, whereas wasps, they actually use their sting to hunt, and they will actually sting their prey, including honeybees, by the way, and that paralyzes their prey, and then they literally will tear them apart before that animal even dies and eat them. Honeybees will only use their sting in defense and only as a last resort. Honeybees, compared to wasps and hornets, are very gentle. I don't know about Mike, but I'll go in and do inspections in my hive with no gloves on. And I'll have bees walking all over my hands while I'm doing that. And I rarely get stung. Mm-hmm. Don't get me wrong. I do get stung, but it doesn't happen very often. Generally my bees don't mind too much that I'm in the hive. A lot of that has to do with making sure you pick the right time to go in and do an inspection. You don't want to do it on an overcast day. They're generally kind of grumpy in that just like humans. They don't like cold, rainy days. So
we have a lot in common. Well, we talked a little bit about the mite. Is that really the biggest factor when it comes to the colony collapse disorder that we've been reading about? Or are there other factors that are equally or even more important to that, the colony collapse disorder? Bill, what do you think?
Well, the thing about the varroa mite is a varroa mite is a parasite for a honeybee like a tick is a parasite for a human. They will latch on and feed on the bees. The prevailing theory used to be that they were feeding on the bee's blood, which is called hemolymph. More recent studies have shown that they actually feed on the fatty tissues that the bees have in them. That in and of itself, you know, any good parasite, any successful parasite doesn't kill the host. So the varroa, just the act of the varroa attaching to a bee, it might weaken the bee, but it's not going to kill it. But the problem is these varroa mites carry bacteria and viruses of diseases that do affect the bees. So there are a variety of illnesses that can get into your hives, and the varroa mite is the attack vector that is used to introduce those into the hive. So as a beekeeper, you know, we try to keep our varroa mite population under control using a variety of management methods. But the bottom line is the bees take an active part in that too. There is a particular behavior that's referred to as hygienic behavior that you want to see in a beehive. It's generally a genetic behavior. It's not a learned behavior. So if you have a queen that has the right genes, you'll have what's considered a hygienic hive. And they will actually take care of policing the varroa mites to a certain degree themselves. But there's no substitute for every once in a while they need a hand. And we as beekeepers have to do what we can to help that.
You're listening to Bill Korb and Dr. Mike Bauer on Route 51, a discussion on Wisconsin pollinators and their role in our state's ecosystem. Coming up, all about beekeeping, and a bit later in the program, we'll hear from naturalist Sue Crisp. We'll answer your questions, too, when you call us at 800-780-9742. You can also send an email to us at ideas@wpr.org. I'm Shireen Seward. This is Route 51 on Wisconsin Public Radio. She can sing those banjo knees and get down real low and do the honeybee. Do the honeybee, do the honeybee, come on. Do the honeybee, do the honeybee, come on. Do the honeybee, do the honeybee, come on. Do the honeybee, do the honeybee, shake your sting. We're back on Route 51. I'm Shireen Seward. Dr. Michael Bauer and Bill Korb are our guests today for a discussion on pollinators and their importance in Wisconsin. What would you like to know? You can email us at ideas@wpr.org or join us by phone. The number to call, 800-780-9742. Later in the program, we'll hear from Sue Crisp with ideas on how to create a pollinator-friendly environment at home. I have to say, I see a lot of signs in people's yards in the summer saying they've sprayed for mosquitoes. Of course, nobody likes mosquitoes, but I know that mosquitoes are actually pollinators too. Aside from that, though, do those pesticides and herbicides have an impact on bees and other pollinators as well? Is that something that we should be worried about, Dr. Bauer?
Yeah, it sure is, especially the commercial spraying or the overhead spraying with airplanes. That really affects the bees. Down in Florida, when I pollinate blueberries, we've got to be really careful when they spray those. And the same out in California with the almonds. Most of those commercial growers know only to spray at night when the bees aren't flying. But, you know, just everybody is spraying for everything, even the weeds in your lawn and bugs, and all of that just adds up. And some of those pesticides, especially the fungicides, are really fat soluble, so they stay in the frames and the wax for long periods of time. That affects the broods, it affects the queen rearing, shortens the lives of the bees, so that just weakens them. And then you throw on top of that the Varroa mite that we talked about, which bringing in the disease. Any one of those the bees could tolerate pretty well, but you know, there's just so many of those threats right now, and so many people using pesticides kind of in sort of non-approved ways, that really affect not just the honeybees, but all the pollinators.
Well, Bill, you didn't grow up on a beekeeping farm. What drew you to it? You're obviously very passionate about it. So when did this all happen?
Well, I just got into it in 2016. I'd been toying with the idea for quite a while. We live on 5 acres outside of Chippewa Falls. In fact, I'm only about a half mile from Lake Wissota State Park, which your next guest is actually affiliated with. But you know, I've kept chickens over the years. I had we've had horses for 25 years, and I always thought that bees would be interesting. My wife and I are organic gardeners. And I thought, I'd read that having a colony of bees near your garden could really improve the yield that you got from your garden. We have some fruit trees and as Mike mentioned, we have blueberry bushes as well. And it is absolutely true that since I started keeping bees, my apple trees, if I didn't go out and thin out my apple trees, I kid you not, when my bees get to my apple trees, they pollinate every single blossom that the trees put out. And every single blossom turns into an apple. And there's no way my trees could support the weight, just the sheer weight of apples that would result. I have to go out and thin them out. That was not the case before I had bees. So there's really, you know, you talked during the introduction that a third of the food that we eat, we can directly attribute to the impact of pollinators. That is absolutely true. I've seen it in my own yard, in my own garden. So anyhow, that's what got me interested is, you know, I thought, well, this would be a good complement to our gardening. And you talked about the colony collapse disorder. That was really big in the news 10, 12 years ago. And so I was aware that there was threats to the bees, and I thought, well, you know, I can improve the local environment and benefit our garden at the same time. It seemed like a logical thing to do, and I've never looked back. It's one of the most fascinating hobbies I've ever had. I'm an IT guy by day, but I'll tell you what, a bad day in the apiary beats a good day in the IT world any day of the week.
Mike, what about you? How did you get into this? What drew you to it?
Well, my father was a beekeeper. He had about 25 colonies the whole time I was growing up. And I just hated going to help him out in that bee yard and getting stung. And I vowed I would never have bees. Well, that was in northern Minnesota. When I moved here to central Wisconsin, I was trying to raise raspberries, and that was the time when the Varroa mite was really hitting the native pollinators really hard, and I just could not get any fruit set. So I made the mistake of complaining to my father about that. Well, the next weekend, he drove 4 colonies from Duluth, Minnesota, down to Waupaca, Wisconsin, so that I would have some bees, which promptly died because they were so infested with mites. So that's kind of how I got into it. I had the equipment and it got started. And then I got what I call the bee disease. You get, you know, two colonies in the spring of the year. Well, they get strong. Well, what do you do with them? Either you got to split them or they're going to swarm. So now you got four. And then pretty soon I ended up with 100 colonies and now have about 500 colonies. It's just the bee disease. So that's kind of how I got into it. And I retired as a family doc and became a full-time beekeeper about a year and a half ago now.
Well, what kind of bees do you keep, Bill? How many bees do you have?
Right now, I actually have five hives, and there are a number of different varieties. As Mike alluded to, most of them are European. The variety that I have started keeping most recently, they're called Saskatraz. They're named after a university in Saskatchewan, where an entomologist did a research program about 15 years ago looking for selectively breeding for particular attributes. The four attributes he was most concerned with was overwintering, which we already talked about, honey production, which, of course, as a beekeeper who's harvesting honey, you want to maximize that. Gentleness. People don't think of honeybees as being gentle, but as I mentioned to you, I rarely get stung by my bees, even though I work with them barehanded. They will sting, but they sting as a defense of the colony. An individual bee will not get angry with you and sting you just because you pissed it off. They will do it to protect their hive. When a honeybee stings you, her stinger is barbed and will actually stain your skin when she flies away. Within a half an hour, that individual bee will be dead. They intuitively know that if they sting, they're going to die. So it is a last defense. They literally are giving their life for their colony. So they are, by nature, they are nowhere near as aggressive as the wasps or hornets that we talked about earlier. And then the fourth attribute that the Saskatraz project was selecting for was hygienic behavior, so that they could control the mites within their hive as much as possible. I've been keeping the Saskatraz for about 4 years now, and I find that in general they have been more successful than the bees I kept before that. Now, with that said, I've also learned a lot about being a beekeeper, and I'd like to think I've become a better beekeeper in the last 4 years too. So. But the bottom line is if you have good bees, bad beekeepers can be successful with good bees.
So. Right. Okay. We had an email from Amanda who rightly wanted to point out that wasps and hornets are indeed important native pollinators as well. And if they're not posing a direct threat, it's probably best to just respect them and leave them be. So thank you for that email, Amanda. Appreciate that. Mike, I'm curious. Tell us a little bit about what happens inside a hive. What does the activity look like in there?
Well, I tell you, it's like a little miracle every time you open up a colony. I just love everything about it, the sound, the smell, the activity. So when I go into a colony, we look for a number of things. The most important one is, do you still have a queen? So you look for, you know, is she laying eggs? Is the health of the brood okay? And the bees will form a cluster almost like the size of a basketball. It's kind of in the middle of the colony, and then put honey and pollen to the outside of that. So you're looking for, you know, do they have adequate honey stores and pollen stores? And you can see the different kinds of pollen that they're bringing in at different times of year. You can tell it by the color of the pollen. And then you're checking for a disease. There's several diseases that you got to kind of keep your eye out for. So those, and do they have adequate space? You don't want to give them too much space so that they can't take care of, because then you get invasive things like this, the wax moth or other things that can come in there, even mice sometimes if it's really weak. So the three main things when I teach beekeeping that beekeepers look for is, number one, do you have a queen? Because without a queen, you got a dead colony. And number two, do they have food? And number three, do they have the appropriate amount of space? And then the last one is looking for the diseases in the colony. So the worker bee, which are all female bees, go through various stages in their life. The first part, they're basically hive bees for about 2 weeks, maybe a little bit longer, where they're in there, they are feeding the larva, they're doing the house cleaning, they just stay in the colony. And then after that point, they become the field bees, where they're out collecting pollen and nectar. So you're watching to see what they're bringing in. What's the population of young bees versus the old bees, and that sort of stuff. That's what you're looking for inside a colony. But it's a flurry of activity, and you can watch the little worker bees signaling to the other bees the direction where the other bees need to go to find a honey source or a pollen source. They do this little bee dance, which is just really fun to see. So there's lots going on. I refer to one bee year. If you're a beekeeper and have one colony for 1 year, that's 1 year of bee experience. So you think running 500 colonies for 10 years, you would have seen everything there is to see in a bee colony. But I'll tell you, I am amazed every day I go out there. You think, how on earth did this just happen? It's just amazing. And I think any beekeeper will tell you the same thing. It's just never the same thing every time you go in there.
Bill, does each hive have kind of its own personality, or is one hive the same as the next?
Yeah, absolutely. Every hive is an individual. So, you know, a lot of people want to look at a single honeybee and think, well, this single honeybee is, you know, it's its own being, its own, you know, independent being. But the truth of it is the entire hive, an entire colony, we refer to that as a superorganism. So while an individual bee isn't particularly intelligent and one single bee couldn't make all of the decisions that are necessary in the hive, the bees collectively, they make incredibly complex decisions. Now, you know, we refer to the bee that lays all the eggs in the hive, we refer to her as the queen. Well, given the way that royalty works in humankind, people think, well, the queen, she's sitting on her throne and she's ruling and she's telling all the other bees what to do. That is actually not the case. And in fact, I tell people that the queen is actually the hardest working bee in the hive. She can lay, I've read, she can lay three times her body weight in eggs in a single day.
Wow.
She doesn't, you know, I mentioned earlier that the bees go out on cleansing flights to get rid of their waste. She doesn't. She's not allowed to. She doesn't have time to do that. She needs to stay in the hive so that she can be focused on her job, which is building the population of that hive so that they can take most advantage of the nectar flow when it starts. So she's in there laying eggs. She has a number of bees that are, they're called attendant bees, that they actually gather around her and they cater to her needs. They bring her food to make sure that she's well fed. And they take her waste away and dispose of it for her. She's not allowed to do that. So she works really hard. Now every bee works hard. Bees don't have leisure time like humans do. They literally work around the clock. They don't sleep at night. They're actually doing things in the hive at night when we're all sound asleep in our beds. They're still working. That's the nature of it. So every single colony, they basically have their own personality. And I've mentioned to lots of people that when I talk about beekeeping, it's equal part art and science. The science, you understand, you know, the physiology of a bee, what their needs are, what kind of food sources they need, and that's all fine. But the art comes in to looking at the bees. They communicate with each other via pheromones, i.e. through smell. Whereas, you know, obviously they're nonverbal, but bees don't buzz to each other. Now, Mike did mention that they'll do a waggle dance to communicate, you know, the direction and distance to a particular food source. But the vast majority of their communication is through these pheromones. The queen emits pheromones. Every single queen has a unique scent. So a bee from one hive, if it tries to go into another hive, there will be guard bees at the entrance that will recognize that bee is an interloper because it doesn't smell right. It doesn't smell like the pheromones of their own queen, and they will actually keep that bee from coming into the hive. So they don't communicate with us as the beekeeper directly. They don't tell us things. So it's kind of like reading the tea leaves. We're watching their behavior. We're looking at what they're doing, and that's how we as a beekeeper have to decide, is there anything I need to do for this hive? Are they self-sufficient? Do I need to treat for mites, or what do I need to do? We do that by doing these inspections in the hive.
So, Mike, there's some great beekeeping groups throughout Wisconsin. You both are involved in those. But for someone who just wants to try it on their own, what are the basics that we need to get started?
Well, yeah, we are really fortunate here in Wisconsin. We've got some great organizations. Pretty much every county has a local county beekeeping group. And to find them, you can just call your extension agent. They would know how to get in touch. And I don't know about Bill's place, but here in the Waupaca County, we have a mentorship program. So if it's a new beekeeper, we try to partner a new beekeeper up with an experienced beekeeper. Because you can read all you want to do, all you want about beekeeping, but you really just got to get in a hive and see a hive. So it really helps to have a mentor, somebody who can just show you how to handle frames, what to look for. And, you know, to get some bees in the spring, get some equipment and read a little bit about stuff, but then try to find a mentor through a local bee group. Most beekeepers are thrilled to teach another beekeeper beekeeping. That's at least what I found. Get started.
A lot of resources out there. Bill, I wanted to take a moment to ask you about the Chippewa Eau Claire Apiary. What is that and how'd you get involved in that?
The Chippewa Eau Claire Community Apiary is a joint project of the Chippewa Eau Claire Beekeepers Association, which is our local beekeepers club. And Xcel Energy. Xcel, with their power lines going all over the state, they have lots of fairly wild land. And they've actually set up a spot for us on their property that allows us, members of the Beekeepers Association, to site hives on that area. And they've also planted pollinator-friendly plants in that area to promote, you know, to give the bees something to feed on. So it's something that we've been working on for the last few years. It's become fairly popular. And like Mike talked about, a lot of our new beekeepers that just are getting into it, some of them don't necessarily have a spot to site a hive on their own property. So they'll set one up in the community apiary. And then the experienced beekeepers in our area will actually mentor those new beekeepers and help them, you know, learn the ropes of keeping bees.
Well, I want to thank both of you. This has been a fascinating discussion. A sincere thanks to Bill Korb and Dr. Michael Bauer for joining us today on Route 51. Just a fascinating discussion, and we would love to have another one in the coming months for sure. After the break, Sue Crisp will be joining us with information on planting techniques and other ways to ensure the health of the pollinator population in Wisconsin. We'd like to hear from you, too. You can join us by calling 800-780-9744. You can also send an email to ideas@wpr.org. I'm Shereen Seward. This is Route 51 on Wisconsin Public Radio. We're back on Route 51. I'm Shereen Seward. Our discussion on pollinators in Wisconsin continues now with Sue Crisp. Sue is a naturalist and camp host at Lake Wissota State Park, where she is responsible for planting and planning 1,750 square feet of native plants to promote pollinator health. What would you like to know? You can email us at ideas@wpr.org or join us by phone at 800-780-9742. Sue, thank you for joining us on Route 51 today. We're so pleased to have you.
Thank you for having me.
Well, earlier in the program, we spent a lot of time talking about bees, but they are not the only pollinators. What other species are we talking about?
Well, there's a lot of variety of butterflies, including tiger swallowtail, black swallowtail, admirals, monarchs, which most of us are familiar with, red admiral, painted lady, Kärntner blue, crescent butterflies, and there's also stuff like the Hoover flies, which are also called flower flies.
So how does pollination work with butterflies? Take me through this process.
Okay, butterflies will go and they use their proboscis and their bodies, and they'll suck the nectar, and therefore they will pollinate that way.
And what about beetles? Are they pollinators as well?
Yes, they are. And they will go after the plants and after the pollen and nectar, just like other insects do.
What should I look for in a plant to attract pollinators at home? Are butterflies pretty specific about what they prefer?
Lots of butterfly species are, like the swallowtails, like willows, cherry, and birch trees, and the black swallowtails, like carrots, parsley, dill, and monarchs, of course, like the milkweed species, like butterfly weed, showy milkweed, common butterfly milkweed, and for nectar plants, they like things like metal blazing star and prairie blazing star. You get painted ladies, they like thistles and pearly everlasting. And you got the carnivore blue, which is an endangered species, likes wild lupin. And it's very specific what it likes. The question mark likes elms, hackberry, and basswoods. And crescent butterflies, like one of them, the things they like is smooth blue asters.
Are those pretty common pollinator plants in this area? Are they things that will thrive in our climate here?
All the ones I mentioned do survive in this area.
I know it can be bit challenging when we're in Wisconsin, for sure.
Well, I gave you all native plants that are either native or, or there are trees that are for our area.
Well, let's talk a little bit about weeds. Now, we city dwellers here sure hate those dandelions in our yard and the coneflowers, but are those actually good for pollination?
Well, for this time of year, the dandelions haven't hit my yard yet, but they will be soon. But they are one of the first things that they have, plus the Creeping Charlie, that to pollinate for the bees and the butterflies, et cetera, because there's just about nothing left here at that time.
Do they serve any other purposes as well?
Well, the dandelions are also good for the bees at this time of the year. And if you consider that they're promoting no mow maize, that the pruning that for insects of all kinds, they said in the Appleton area that the insects increased tenfold by leaving the grasses and the nectar plants and the pollinating flowers and weeds this time in my year for the whole month of May increased tenfold.
Well, I'm glad you brought up no mow May, because it's really something that people have been talking about a lot. Big movement. We're seeing that in cities across the state. Wausau, Appleton, Stevens Point, for example, they're encouraging homeowners to adopt this no mow May standard. But some cities are definitely not. I believe Little Chute is one that is saying, absolutely not. We will fine you if you don't mow your lawn. So what's the idea behind no mow May? Why is it May that this is happening?
Well, the month of May does not have a lot of other flowers available to the pollinators. A lot of the flowers that we do like and that are early, like tulips and daffodils, et cetera, are not really good pollinator flowers.
So May is the time that these things happen. I guess, do you do no mow May yourself? I'm curious.
Yes, I do.
Okay, we did it last year. We had a very unhappy neighbor who didn't like it very much. I guess people have a love-hate relationship with it. How important do you think it really is?
Well, if you consider that so many of the insects are decreasing or endangered, it's wonderful to have that. And, I mean, the use of pesticides and habitat loss has created a problem for pollinators. And one-third of what we eat relies on pollinators.
Earlier in the program, I asked our earlier guests their thoughts on pesticides and those mosquito sprays. What are your thoughts on them? I mean, with your role, what should people do? Can you use those pesticides and mosquito sprays without hurting the pollinators?
Well, if you use those things like pyrethrin on your clothes, you keep the ticks and mosquitoes from bugging you, but you're not infecting all the plants around you. So I will use them on myself to protect myself from being bit, but I'm not putting it out on my lawn or in the park to for anything. There's one thing that people can do is make sure that if they have barberry, which is an invasive, if they get it rid of it, they will decrease tick habitat.
Well, my yard's got a lot of shade, and folks who live in my neighborhood have similar issues. We have so many trees. So what are some good shade plants to encourage pollinators like butterflies?
Wild geranium, columbine, and Jacob's ladder are a few of those that you can use.
Does a plant's color make any kind of difference?
Oh, yes, it does. There are certain colors that are attracted, that bees and butterflies are attracted to. So, you know, like native bees like blue, violet, purple, white, and yellow, and butterflies in general like deep purple flowers. And if you have, and hummingbirds are also a pollinator, and they like tubular flowers, and especially red.
Are these species really able to detect color, or is it more about the scent that they give off? What is it?
They actually can tell by the rays from the light. They can actually tell colors, and they are affected so that if you use a cultivar instead of a native plant, they don't always recognize it, or they're not attracted. In fact, most insects are attracted to native plants 4 times more than they are to the cultivars and other types of hybridized plants.
What about the shape? Does the shape of a plant have anything to do with it?
Oh, yes. Like the hummingbirds like tubular shaped, and some of the insects do not like double-petaled flowers. They're not attracted to those. It makes them harder for them to get to or pollinate.
What about, are there any native plants that you would say we should avoid placing in our yards?
Well, most of the ones that I don't, some of them would be kind of a little bit aggressive, so you wouldn't want them. You know, one of the common things you don't want would be like lilies of the valley, which is not truly a native, but there's a lot of it. And those are aggressive. And most of us don't like prickly ash, which is a native, which is a hose plant for giant swallowtail butterflies, but I would not put that in my yard.
Is there a list of plants that we should take a look at to avoid that are perhaps prohibited in this area?
Yes, there's a list by the Wisconsin DNR. It's called NR40, and there's quite a lot of plants on that list. And some of them are considered restrictive, and some of them are prohibitive. And the prohibitive ones are ones that are not yet in the state or are only in a few places, and they want to prevent or eradicate whatever is there if it's in a pocket. And then the restricted invasives are already established here, and they can have an effect on the environment or economic problems. And both types are regulated. You cannot transfer without a permit to any of these plants.
Are there any other rules that I should follow when I'm thinking about this and, you know, trying to create the best possible habitat for pollinators in my yard? What other rules should I be looking at to follow?
Well, there's quite a few things that you should consider. You consider the moisture content of the area you have, how much sun it has, and the blooming time. You should try to have at least three types of blooming plants at any given time, so that you have early spring bloomers and you have middle of the summer, and then you have late summer, early fall plants, so that you have some of each.
What's the best way to grow a butterfly garden?
Well, the best way is to start with a clean slate to make sure that you start by, one of the things you could do is mow off the grass that you have there real, real short. Put down 4 to 8 layers of newspaper, depending on who you say you look at. They depend how many sheets they did. We did 8 at Lake Wissota. Then wet it down and put some mulch and leave it for, we left it from spring until late August and then planted in plugs in the area. And there's a lot of catalogs available, like Prairie Moon or Native Prairie, or some of the local nurseries do have native plants, but you can also look online and find some of the list. And they have it by type of, moisture, soil type. So if you have sandy soil, which a lot of us do, that you put those kind of plants in, and, you know, do you have full sun, do you have, et cetera. And one thing about good about these putting native plants is the fact that they don't take a lot of maintenance once they're established.
Well, what do you think, do pollinators need different things at different times of the year? Is there something that we can do all year round, or is this just a spring summer thing?
No, there's something all year, because it's good to leave like Joe Pye weed and a few other ones that have hollow stems for the solitary native bees to nest in for the winter. So it gives you a winter accent too. Some of these plants look really attractive with snow on them.
Oh, sure. I have to wonder what it's like to do your job. I mean, how do you plan for such a big area, and, you know, with keeping all of these things in mind? What's that like?
Well, for me, it's a joy. I will be going out I planted 40 trees in the last week out there, so we'll have more increased of, because we put in native trees, and a lot of caterpillars for these insects eat a lot. They'll increase their weight by 3,000 times for the time they hatch.
Are caterpillars pollinators as well?
Not truly caterpillars. They do in the next stage, but
not as the caterpillar. Well, just, you know, ultimately, what is the one best thing that homeowners can do to really encourage pollinator growth in their community and in their own backyard? What's the best thing we can do?
Well, there's a couple of things they can do. Is stop using pesticides, and if, you know, most smaller gardens, all they have to do is pick off the insects that are causing problems. If they have Japanese beetles or whatever, hand pick up. And another thing is not to use insecticides, and which are like pesticides, and also the herbicides, which deteriorate, you know, takes out a lot of the plants.
Sure. Well, thank you so much, Sue. This has been fascinating and great information. You're listening to Route 51. I'm Shereen Seewert, extending a sincere thanks to our guests, Sue Crisp, Dr. Michael Bauer, and Bill Korb. Our producers are Joy Ratch-Kramer and Kate Spranger. Our executive producer is Rick Ryer. Rick is also our on-air producer today. Special music from Banana Slug String Band, The Landman Brothers, Lauren Elena, and Chicken Wire Empire. Thanks to John Alton Altenburg for the Route 51 theme. You can hear the archive of today's program, as well as our previous programs at wpr.org/Route 51. You can also subscribe to our podcast. It's available from your favorite platform. If you have an idea for a future program, email us at ideas@wpr.org. We'd love to hear from you. Next week, we'll be back with another fascinating discussion, and we hope you'll join us. Until then, we're heading out of town.
You belong among the wildflowers. You belong on a boat out at sea. Sail away, kill off the hours. You belong somewhere you feel free.